Discourse on Habeas Corpus by Gary Hunt, Outpost of Freedom. Episode 11, Habeas Corpus to the U.S. Supreme Court, continued. Also in that June 22nd letter was a requirement that I resubmit copies to all the respondents, which listed grown to 9 people at this point in time. So I had to go to the cost of copying and the cost of, well, this time I used priority mail. Since the court can use priority mail, I supposed I could, and it saved me $1.50 or $2 per service. But the ordeal of it was getting old by this time. Expense in just copies and postage. Now, since it had not gone to a single justice as I had requested, and at the same time they did change, I had styled it or captioned it, In re Larry Michael Myers. He's the detained party in all the historical ones. The detained party, if an attorney filed for them, they didn't put the attorney's name up. They put the name of the incarcerated person. So when they docketed with the court, they did change the caption on it to In re Gary Hunt. I guess they thought I was in jail. I mean, these guys are kind of idiots. They may have thought that. But because of that, I filed an emergency petition for a writ of mandamus, which was given to them, sent to them on September 21st, 2013. And I provided the table of court authority, statement for basis of jurisdiction in the Fifth Circuit Justice of the United States Supreme Court, statement of facts, authorities, arguments, and conclusions, in which I argued that this should have gone to Justice Scalia as it was directed and as established by historical judicial precedents, and that the caption should be changed to In re Larry Michael Myers, since he's the one incarcerated. So this went to them, certified return and receipt. This time, to make sure it got there, went certified return receipt. And after a while, and after receiving no response regarding the emergency petition for writ of mandamus, emergency means that it's supposed to, and it can't be an emergency or something, they should respond. So now that was sent on September 22nd. And on October 12th, I sent a follow-up letter on the mandamus. What is the status of the emergency petition for writ of mandamus that I filed with this court? I still have never received a response regarding the mandamus. However, the court, and I had thought it was going to be in September, but on October 7th, the court denied hearing. They didn't hear and reject it for cause or anything. They just chose not to hear the habeas corpus that had been filed. So on November 1st, I filed a petition for rehearing, explaining to them why they should rehear it, the sacred writ, the right in the Constitution. You've given no cause for rejection of this. Addressed everything I could think of, and so on December 2nd, the court, in a docket session, denied the petition for rehearing. So the question is, I suppose, that we need to know why it is that no court in this country will hear the sacred writ. It's not been suspended, because suspended, by definition, is for a period of time. But when it can't be heard at all, when it's just ignored by the court, now, when they ignore it, they deny hearing it, and that's ignoring it. They're saying it doesn't matter, we're not going to hear this, there's no legitimacy, there's no lawfulness to what you're trying to do. The consequence is not that it's been suspended, as many people have suspected, but it's been eliminated from the Constitution. It has been torn out and cast away. Now, there are a lot of claims about denial of constitutional rights, but in all of those, there's counterarguments that may or may not make sense. They're subtle. It's an interpretation of what it means. But here is a right embodied in the Constitution, felt important enough that it wasn't held off for the Bill of Rights, but was embodied in the Constitution. And the government has rejected it outright. They just rejected it. and will not hear it. The documentation on this case, and I've kept a record of every bit of correspondence and everything else, the documentation on this case is unbelievable, and first the court acting as a filter in trying to keep the court from even hearing a matter before it. And then we've got a year before they, almost a year, short 11 days short of a year from when it was first submitted to that court when they denied the petition for rehearing. I'm sorry. It was over a year. It was December 2nd when they denied the petition for rehearing. So over a year when it should have taken less than 30 days by the statutes, we've got a year tied up, and the expense and the fact that Lori Michael Myers has been in prison this entire time. What's wrong with this country? This is irrefutable, people. This is irrefutable. Now, one question still remains that has been asked many times, and that is, what are the charges against Lori Michael Myers that we're challenging as to the constitutionality? Well, I need to remind you of Abelman v. Booth, where the constitutional nexus existed. I need to remind you of Barron v. City of Baltimore, where the federal government had no jurisdiction over what Baltimore did, even though it deprived Barron of reasonable use of his land without due process and without compensation. Dred Scott v. Sanford, the case where the he had no right to go before the court, but they accepted it anyway, and they that there was a constitutional nexus on that as well, but not the legitimacy of standing that should have been denied Dred Scott. We've got In re Lane case, which clearly sets the jurisdiction that once any territory or state has established a legislative, executive, and judicial branch, the government's jurisdiction ceases. We've got United States versus Reese, wherein it was determined that the amendment, 15th Amendment to the Constitution, did not extend the authority to the government to go beyond a certain point, and then their act of 1870, they went beyond that point, and therefore the court said these two sections, Section 3 and 4 of the Act, are rejected. They're not, they don't have the constitutional nexus. And then in 1908, we've got the recognition that 14th Amendment citizens and citizens of a state, in this case New Jersey, in Twining versus State of New Jersey, are distinct, and that jurisdiction which may apply to one will not apply to the other. Now, in the statement of facts that was given in the petition from the beginning to end is that Lori Michael Myers is a citizen of Florida, currently incarcerated, and that Gary Hunt is a citizen of Florida, currently residing in California, the state of in California, the state. So the elements of distinction between a 14th Amendment citizen and a state citizen, as recognized in 1908, 107 years ago, or six years ago, is clearly established. I find nothing in Supreme Court decisions that diminishes or removes that distinction, but still it can't be heard. They don't want to test something as significant as the constitutionality of statutes promulgated by the government, by the administrative agencies. We also have reference in the Administrative Agency Act of 1946, wherein they admit they're creating a fourth branch of government, but that fourth branch of government in 1946 was going to affect less than 1% of the people of this country. It was going to affect hundreds of thousands, and we had a population at that time of 150 million. So all these issues come together, and the government doesn't want to address it. So the question really arises, as have we moved from a constitutional government into an administrative agency government? Not admiralty jurisdiction, not maritime jurisdiction, not a corporate United States even, but strictly administrative government. Now, when we consider that and understand what was said in that North Carolina decision, Bayard versus Singleton, that if they enact an unconstitutional law, and let's extend that further, how about if the Supreme Court refuses to recognize the right of habeas corpus, does that court by its actions dissolve itself because it was created by the Constitution, and also dissolve the government created by the Constitution, as they said in 1787 in North Carolina during the time of the Constitutional Convention? So now the charges against Larry Michael Myers. Now understand, the question is not whether he committed a crime, but whether the federal government had jurisdiction to deal with that crime based upon a constitutional nexus. The first charge, 18 U.S. Code 371, conspiracy to commit offense or to defraud the United States. Now, that statute says if two or more persons conspire either to commit an offense against the United States or to defraud the United States or any agency thereof in any manner or for any purpose, and one or more of such persons do any act or effect the object of the conspiracy, each shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 5 years or both. So now we look back to both the Act of 1825, where they could only enact laws to punish crimes against government property if it was on land ceded to the government and jurisdiction ceded. Well, in this case, there's no effort to defraud. We're talking about a matter of speech. There was no defrauding. That requires trying to seize property or goods or something like that. But where's the constitutional nexus with this if it is not on ceded land? If it's not on land ceded and jurisdiction ceded, is there a constitutional nexus? Or, if there was a crime, would it come under state law? Next was 18 U.S. Code, Section 372, conspiracy to impede or injure officer. If two or more persons in any state, territory, possession, or district conspire to prevent by force, intimidation, or threat any person from accepting or holding any office, trust, or place of confidence under the United States, or from discharging any duties thereof, or to induce by like means any officer of the United States to leave the place where his duties as an officer are required to be performed, or to injure him in his person or property on account of his lawful discharge of the duties of his office, or while engaged in the lawful discharge thereof, or to injure his property so as to molest, interrupt, hinder, impede him in the discharge of his official duties, each of such persons shall be fined under this title or imprisoned not more than 6 years. Now, the presumption that they can extend this law into the state, when we look back at both the jurisdiction in Henry Lane, where the judicial, executive, and legislative branches are created, do they have authority outside of that realm? Can they impose laws otherwise? Now remember, the Constitution was enacted to keep the federal government from intruding upon the rights of states, and nothing has really changed that relationship, except perhaps if you're a 14th Amendment citizen, which Twining and Cornell were not. So if there was a threat to impede or injure an officer, and in this case it was a sitting federal grand jury, which I'm not sure if they're temporary officers or not, however, that would be within the jurisdiction of the state. The threat would come under the jurisdiction of the state. And I'll give you a good example. In the indictment against Timothy McVeigh, there were 9 instances of, I'm going to put it the way I see it, damage to public property. They did not address 300 murders. They only, even in that courthouse, only had jurisdiction over the 9 truly federal agents that were killed in a consequence of that. Only 9 deaths were addressed in the Tim McVeigh trial. So they understood the limitation there in imposing their authority where they had no authority to impose. Now we'll continue this in the next episode.